listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we take a look at the headlines at consortiumnews.com with Editor-in-Chief Joe Lauria. Well, Joe, let's see. We're starting looking at the front page again, and I was kind of surprised. I saw all this stuff about with different pieces by Bob Perry and about Bob Perry, and then I realized it must be that time of year. It's the end of the year when people make their tax-deductible donations to their various causes, and it must be Fund Drive. So good luck with Fund Drive, but I want to go into some of the articles that are not part of that, looking at starting with John Kiriakou's piece about Alexis Tsipras and Syriza, which is something I've wanted to revisit ever since we were reporting on the election that brought Syriza to power a few years back and the whole drama that played, as opposed to the drachma that played out after that.
Yes, John Kiriakou, who is Greek-American, and he may actually have dual citizenship, but I don't know for sure about that. But so John knows Greece extremely well. He knows the language, and he's lived there for many, many years, as well as here in the States.
He was stationed there, right? Yeah.
Sorry?
He was stationed there, actually.
Yeah. He was stationed there for a while. Before I get to that, though, the second half of the article I want to talk about first briefly, because he does do a pretty good critique. He's not the first one, of course, to critique the hypocrisy and the phoniness, basically, of the Syriza party and the prime minister, who, of course, led the Greeks to people to believe that he was ready to leave the Eurozone and bring back the drachma if this referendum passed. It did pass, and he was caught by surprise, somewhat like Cameron, who had at least the decency to resign when he put Brexit forward. He didn't think
right. It
was any chance it would win, and he wanted to just sort of bury this issue because it was so divisive within the government and his party. So he had the thing, and Brexit won, and
he
stepped down.
Right.
Whereas this guy, Tsipras, is still the prime minister, and he really betrayed the Greek people and forced – Varoufakis, the economics minister who did the negotiating with Europeans, to resign. So he does a pretty good critique about how the guy has been pretty much a hypocrite and a failure.
Yeah.
It's the first part of the article that's extremely interesting. And something that might be in John's book, he wrote a book, I believe. I have not read the book. I presume most of the readers of Consortium News or your listeners have not read it. So he reveals something here, I don't think, again, for the first time, but even if it's not, it's for a lot of people the first time, and that was that he was stationed from 1998 to 2000 as a CIA officer in Athens, because John Kiriakou was a CIA agent, not an analyst back in Langley like Ray McGovern was, actually in the field, carrying gun-carrying, covert CIA agent, the ones of film and book fame, those type, you know. So he was really out there on the ground, and he worked in Athens. And there's this group called 17 November, which since 1990s has killed 23 people through assassination, mostly foreign diplomats, a Greek publisher, a member of parliament, a CIA station chief in Athens, two U.S. defense attachés, a U.S. Air Force sergeant, and his neighbor was a British defense attaché who was killed in August of 2000. And John found out that he was on the list, and he was able to get out of the country and survive. So he was targeted by the 17 November group, and he made it out. And now why he brings this up is because Tsipras, the prime minister now, in John's estimation, because he's been such a failure on the promises he made on the economic issues, on the relationship with the EU and the banks and the Troika and all of that, he's trying to do something to placate his critics on the left. And he decided he wanted to give amnesty to a lot of these 17 November members who have been in prison. And John, because he was the target, he has a personal stake in that. He's not unbiased, says that this is wrong, that these guys were terrorists, and that the United States has given him instructions not to let them out, and he's disobeying America and this and that. So that's why John is taking, and I made it clear he's not unbiased in the second paragraph or third. It starts that way. I'm not unbiased on this issue because these guys try to kill me. But I wanted to raise another issue with you, Don, and I raised it with John, but he didn't want to engage me. I did it by email. I don't know whether he saw the email, and when I see him next time, I will see if he wants to talk about it. It's just a technical legal issue, really. Is terrorism, in my estimation, first of all, it's never been defined by the General Assembly of the United Nations, so countries cannot agree on a firm definition of terrorism. One man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, but I generally go by, and a lot of people do, that it has to be conducted by a non-state actor, not a government person. Could be sponsored, paid for by a government, but the actors themselves are non-governmental, and they target innocent, random civilians or high-value target, and not caring that innocent, random civilians will be killed for political reasons.
Right.
That's why I don't believe a state can commit terrorism. I think states commit war crimes and crimes against humanity, which in my view are worse than terrorism, because it usually involves far more numbers of dead when you're bombing a country than one terrorist bombing in a cafe. So that's a whole other discussion we could have another time. People argue that Israel is a terrorist state. I say they sponsor terrorism. The United States does.
Right.
Certainly Saudi Arabia
right.
does. And
right.
Many countries have sponsored terrorism, but the state itself cannot commit terrorism.
So
but
this
anyway,
is something, because, you know, yeah. this principal and agent issue is something that kind of, you know, befuddles the conversation, you know, when you're trying to define terms. For example, exactly, say Israel was a sponsor of terrorism. So
right.
you find terrorists who are non-state actors and say
right.
Mossad or, you know, the government proper in Israel or whatever, or the U.S. government or CIA hires them.
Yes.
But trains them, you know, organizes
yes.
them, trains them,
arms
pays them.
Them,
but they're not part of the apparatus per se.
Correct.
They're, you know, they're contractors. Well, they're non-state actors, even though they're actually agents of state, and so they're state agents. They're
yes.
not state actors proper. But I look at the government in Ukraine right now. When people talk about where fascism resides in the halls of power, well, okay,
yeah.
if the U.S. government is not controlled by isn't fascist, how is it that they install a fascist government in Ukraine? You know, and
well,
or
Trump,
if
yeah.
so, I mean, it's that you have a principal agent, you know, situation confounding the discussion of terms. And so while we talk about these things, certainly people shouldn't be confused about the fact that when you call something war crime instead of terrorism, that it's somehow worse or better in terms of the set of acts that are conducted, the damage that's done to innocents and to, you know, the public and the world at large in general. They're just, you know, we're sort of using legalisms.
Absolutely.
To try to classify things as one of these
right.
instead of one
it's
of those.
Purely legalistic and academic discussion,
right,
which is,
exactly.
in the end of the day, not all that important because the innocent
right.
people die at the hands of a government, whether they do it directly or they don't. But it does get me sometimes when I see people just using this word terrorism or fascism so easily without understanding, in my opinion, what it means. So,
I mean, it almost comes down to was there withholding in their paycheck? If there wasn't withholding, then you know, then it's a contract
exactly.
payment. Okay.
Yeah,
if it is withholding, they're employees.
Except the New York
right.
state law, maybe they are employees because
right.
they're given instructions,
right.
they're given their equipment.
Right, exactly.
So maybe under labor law, they really are employees of the government, not
right.
independent contractors. Like jihadists in Syria, clearly
right.
backed by Saudi Arabia, by
exactly.
Turkey,
yeah, exactly.
Paid for by the Saudis, directed, right. trained by the U.S., armed, but they don't. You know, they're not the U.S. government. They're not the Saudi government. They
right.
gives them plausible deniability. Let's
right.
face it. That's
right.
one of the reasons to use these guns.
Right.
And by the way, these jihadists have their own. They already have the same aim. So there is a confluence of objectives that come together in
right.
short term. And that's why it's easy to get these guys to do that, because they want to overthrow Assad as well, for example.
Right.
The problem becomes after the guy's overthrown or the war ends, these guys are also usually anti-American as well.
Right. Yeah.
And then they will turn their guns and their bombs against the U.S., Al-Qaeda perhaps being maybe the best example. They were certainly part of the Afghan insurgency against Soviet Union, and then they branched off and started to attack U.S. targets. So this is one of the real problems with that American policy. It shows short term, and they don't look at the blowback. Now, in the piece about John that we're discussing, I see also a legalistic distinction between terrorism and assassination.
Right.
John calls them terrorists. The 17 November is a terrorist organization, he claims, because they carried out assassinations. Where I believe, even though they are non-state actors, I don't believe that they're targeting random innocent civilians. I think they're targeting civilians. It's not random. Now,
specific
these civilians may be innocent.
Ones,
they
right.
may be guilty. They may be guilty, but they're in a system where they have impunity, where they'll never come to trial or be arrested. So a group feels that their crimes are so egregious, they have to take extrajudicial measures because there are no judicial measures available. I'm not defending this. I'm trying to explain it.
Right.
And I do think, though, that there's a big distinction between random civilians dying and targeted civilians. So for me, this is political murder and assassination. And certainly when there was an attempt against Hitler's life and he survived, as one against Pinochet, and he survived. And I think the target of the assassination has to be taken into account because, of course, Olof Palme, John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X were all killed by assassins. And, well, depends on your political view. Because for some people on the right, those were all enemies, and they were maybe happy they died. People celebrate in the south of the U.S. when Kennedy was killed, JFK I'm talking about. So
yep.
there were white supremacists and racists who celebrated, I'm sure, when Martin Luther King was killed. So it's all about the political view. I'm only making a legalistic issue, which I find interesting but not vital to know. But there's a difference in my view between terrorism and assassinations. How do you feel about that, Don?
Yes. You know, there's so much to try to parse. And also, by the way, I mean, an awful lot of the things that you know, bear on this, they're unknowable. I mean, these are things that happen in a back room.
Right.
If you look at the four corners of something, you can see that the people who control the Saudi state, the individuals who control it, who own it, in essence, fund a series of mosques that educate people in a particular religious philosophy that is tailor-made for deployment to solve CIA problems.
Mm-hmm.
People are trained in various countries then trained for military action after they've got the ideological training, and then deployed, and then organized, and then in places like Libya, even given the air cover from the U.S. Air Force,
yep.
Destroying state actors, you know, doing all kinds of things that have huge global repercussions. I mean, the refugee flow from the destruction of Libya is felt on seven continents. You know, all of these things, however, cannot be, or in any event, are not believed to be by most people the actions of a state. And so they're terrorist actions. But, you know, if there's a file somewhere that says, well, here's the memo from Barack Obama to the head of CIA to, you know, the head of the Al-Qaeda group that entered Libya in February of 2011 from Egypt, that says, okay, go get him. Well, now suddenly they are state actors, and so they are terrorists. And so, like I'm saying, there are many documents floating around, perhaps, or other evidence that could change everything we say that we're never going to see, or we may never see, and that may well be unknowable. Sure. So it's kind of angels on the head of a pin to say with certainty which this one is as opposed to that one. But, you know, we can look at what's happened, whose interests were benefited, how people behaved afterwards, you know, what we could have predicted, what did come to pass, and what fallout there was, and make, you know, certain conclusions, and then use those to guess where things are going to go next with a reasonable amount of certainty, whether we know these other things or not.
Absolutely. And the reason these are covert operations, because we're not supposed to know what happened, and it's very hard to find out, even decades later, exactly what happened. But the U.S. is certainly guilty of sponsoring terrorism. I mean, even in Vietnam. Sure. They were doing that as early as Vietnam, and before that, probably under Dulles, Alan Dulles in the 50s, so as CIA director. So that's the point I wanted to make. John's piece is well worth reading. It's extremely interesting. I think his critique of this prime minister, Alexis Tsipras, is right on. And the issue of terrorism, not as a side story, but I felt like doing that because I wanted an opportunity to talk about that.
This one really got me.
If you want to move on.
No, I want to, because a little bit I want to get to this too. We covered this in some depth at the time. I had a member of the European Parliament who's a member of Syriza Party that we spoke with a few times, a member of the Greek Parliament who's a member of Syriza that we spoke with a few times, others, including a number of speeches that Varoufakis had made and some others, including also a few interviews with, Richard Wolff, who knows Varoufakis and who had been speaking with him and other Syriza people at the time. So we covered it in some depth. And you know, what had happened was you started seeing this working class revolt against the EU in the countries where the wealth was being transferred from the working class and even the middle class to the wealthier countries inside the EU. In other words, from places like Greece, Ireland, Spain, Portugal, Italy, to Germany and France. And so you had seen first a right-wing response to that, which is kind of what you saw in Great Britain, at least initially. And then the left saying, some people on the left saying, you know, the Communist Party and Socialist Party have been with this program, the Euro-communists, Euro-socialists, etc. We're going to start standing for actual, you know, communist and socialist and working class politics and force this through from the left. And so they actually had, you know, provided a critique of the left that the voters bought.
Yeah.
And they were supposed to come in and clean it up, and it turned out what they did. I'm not going to impute intent to anyone. That's like a ridiculous, you know, it's a fool's errand. But, you know, you can conclude from looking at it that what happened was they traded in left politics in order to get elected instead of the left, and then they turned around and made an accommodation with Germany.
Right.
They sold to the Greek people after, as John Kiriakou recites through this thing, Tsipras calls for the referendum, the Grexit referendum, and then the night that it happens, according to Varoufakis, says, expletive deleted, we won this. Almost like, now what? And so, you know, so he threw Greece to the wolves anyway, and then Varoufakis, as John relates. But what happened there was something that we saw happen then in other parts of Europe subsequently, where it looked like there was a left rising to actually deal with the whole austerity, you know, the 20-30 year project of, you know, impoverishing the working class and reversing the gains of the post-war period, that people were starting to stand up to deal with that. And those places where the party that advocated this were successful at the ballot box turned around and handed it off once they got in. So, you know, we haven't seen that kind of change happen, despite Syriza, Podemos, and others.
Tsipras better hope there's a shortage of yellow vests in Greece, because this could come back down to get him. Well, and more, I want to say one final thing about him. Again, you're absolutely right. We cannot understand the intentions of an individual. And this was just my feeling at the time. But even before this referendum took place and right after it, my feeling was he was really soaking in the limelight. Being a young, very young guy, wasn't expected to win. He really came out of nowhere. And all of a sudden, he's standing next to Angela Merkel and Hollande, the French president at the time.
Charismatic, and, working class Cameron. Hero.
Yep. And I felt he really, I could see it, although this is pure inference on my part, that he enjoyed being part of this crowd, this very rarefied air. Yeah. And I was frightened that he would be able to be easily manipulated by these much savvier and older and experienced politicians who got to those powerful positions in Europe because they understand the game, and he didn't. And I don't know if that played a role, but I felt he wants to be part of that circle, you know, and he really enjoyed that. That's just an impression. I never met the guy. I don't know him, but that's just my impression. That's part of it, I think. And I think that kind of vanity really does play a role in politics and journalism. But absolutely, that I know much better, because that's my field, where I know journalists are driven by vanity and fame and being part of the crowd, you know, and go along with it. I make a point here. The new National Press Club president in Washington here, I've just become a member, was elected, and they're having a big inauguration at the club, and it costs $115 for a member and a couple, a member and a guest. And you know who's signing in the new president?
Who?
Chief Justice David Souter.
No kidding.
So think about that. We're journalists. We're supposed to be criticizing these guys. We're supposed to be adversarial towards them. We're supposed to keep a distance from them. And they bring in a Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court to inaugurate the president of the press club. I see. I shouldn't be. I just joined them. Already I'm criticizing them publicly here.
No, but that's okay.
But I found that just very symbolic. And there are worse things than that. But that's
I think it's perfect, though.
Let's go on to another story.
No, I think you're absolutely right, though. I mean, not for nothing. You would expect that whoever it is that power finds most offensive at the moment, maybe it would be a judge from Russia or something, would be who you would solicit to swear in. In other words, someone to show that the press is a watchdog over these people, not a lapdog.
Yep. But I don't think there should be any inauguration at all. Just take over the job and do the business.
Yeah, it's not
it's not a really well-known position, even in Washington, who's the president of the National Press Club of the reporters. And she is a working reporter at the club. Who cares? I mean, you know, really.
Right.
I mean, I was a longtime member of the UN Correspondents Association in New York. Uh-huh. I was on executive committee many, many years. And we never had that kind of rubbish, although we did go up and meet the Secretary General once a year and have lunch with him. That was a perk, which I wouldn't all that. But at least you had a chance to ask him questions.
Right, that's right.
You know, it was kind of a press conference, informal, off the record.
Right.
So, but this is like, this is in front of a crowd, and it's
a whole
really
different,
not really surprised me in a way, although it's an establishment organization of the establishment media. So maybe I shouldn't have been that surprised. If you want to go on another story, we could do that.
Yeah, we'll do that. So let's go to the the sequel to the British betrayal of World War I, which takes a look at some real Middle East history that isn't discussed very often, which includes George H.W. Bush, the late recently buried George H.W. Bush.
Right. The top headline is George H.W. Bush's Bitter Legacy in the Middle East, the sequel to the British Betrayal of World War I, is written by Asad Abu Khalil. We've talked about him before on your show, Don, the AKA Angry Arab.
Right.
His insightful analysis of the Middle East, who he knows more about the region than about 100 people I know combined who write about the Middle East. So I'm really happy he writes about the region. And he knows American politics too, because he's been in the U.S. for over 20 years as a professor out in California. So he has a very interesting take on Bush Sr., who died. And he's basically saying that, two things. He really loved the power and the wealth of the Gulf Arabs. He was very impressed by that. He liked sucking up to them. He quotes him in his in a book that's saying, Bush just says, "I'd never seen so much and of nearly every conceivable type of food." So he was impressed by all that stuff. As wealthy as a man as he was, so he was in his class element there.
Right.
But it's really when it comes to Israel that Bush was a really interesting character. Now, under Reagan, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, and when he was Vice President Bush, Reagan, they cut off aid to Israel at one point because of the settlements.
Right.
And at that time, Menachem Begin, I believe the prime minister, said, we only kneel to God, not to the Americans. So they were really pissed off because the Americans were doing this. But when Bush came in, he did similar things. He first, of course, he was UN ambassador, then he became vice president, then he was president, and all through that, and through his early oil days in Texas, he started through the oil lobby in the U.S. To try to get connections with Saudi Arabia. So he traces back in this article all the way to that. But Bush administration banned, George Bush, H.W. Bush, banned Ariel Sharon from entering the U.S. government buildings.
Right.
Because of his statements against the U.S. role in the peace process. Do you tell me another, and I'm loath to praise this guy, George H.W. Bush, you tell me another administration, maybe Jimmy Carter would do something like that. He certainly, since being president, has been very vocal in support of the Palestinians. But aside from Carter, do you know any other president who would do such a thing?
No, and actually, he makes note of the fact that when Jack Kemp, who was the HUD secretary at the time, wanted to meet with Sharon, James Baker, the White House chief of staff, told him, meet him outside government buildings.
Yeah, I'm serious about this.
Yep.
So he was cool to the Israelis when he had to be. And then, of course, he was dogged by Israeli lobby and Israeli supporters for years by a quote that he made, which was because of his more even-handed view, let's put it, towards Israel, or not, suck up right. view to Israel, like almost every president does.
Right.
He once said, I'm one lonely guy fighting
the
lobby on the Hill.
1,000 lobbyists, yeah.
1,000 lobbyists, 1,000 pointers of light and 1,000 lobbyists.
That's what he said.
Yeah, so that is an extraordinary statement for anybody in American public life to make about Israel.
Yep.
But for the sitting U.S. president to make it, tells you something, that he had a little bit of independence with Israel, and that might be the only silver lining in the 4 years of Bush's presidency and his entire career as CIA director. And we talked about that, I think, on the last show. We talked a little bit about Bush because he had just died. So, but this was just a look at his Middle East positions, and it was worth bringing this up again, that he was branded an anti-Semite for deferring 120 days, $10 billion in loan guarantees to Israel. Imagine that.
I know.
That made him an anti-Semite because he just really.
But on the other side of the coin, he started a war against Iraq. In 1990, that's still going on. He completely destroyed that rival to Israel in the region, and have as he points out in the article, U.S. bases and military action: Iraq, Kuwait, Qatar, Libya, Saudi Arabia, Oman, the United Arab Republic, Syria, and a whole bunch of other places where they never had been before.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That first Gulf War was, while it didn't have the same destructiveness as his son's war, it was a horrendous war because there was an opportunity to solve that war. Saddam put out a peace deal to the Arab League. It was totally ignored. He was willing to withdraw under certain conditions. They never even explored that seriously. Although, I have to say, this was still back in the day where the U.S. at least made a pretense of diplomacy. So he sent Jim Baker, who then became his his Secretary of State, if you recall, to meet with what was his name?
Tariq Aziz.
Foreign Minister of Iraq at the time. They had the cameras rolling on the table, and they spoke at least, but I think it was all for show because they had made up their mind. They were going to go to war, but Bush got what his son couldn't get, which was a UN authorization. It may have been a little easier because there was an invasion and occupation of another sovereign state by Iraq. So under the UN charter, that was technically certainly a violation. So Bush was able to put together a coalition of the willing. And another thing that was interesting is that he was able to get Israel, if you recall, not to respond when Saddam sent Scuds to Israel, and the Israelis were fuming. They wanted to respond, and Bush was able to stop them from doing that to further inflame the war or engage Israel directly into the war. So that was another kind of an achievement in a backhanded way. But his war on, as you say, it's very good observation you made that this war is still going on. It's basically the same war because it was in the interim was all about weapons inspections and very onerous sanctions that killed up to 500,000 Iraqi children, for which Madeleine Albright told Leslie Stahl in 60 Minutes that it was worth it.
Yep. And we got about 3 minutes left, maybe 2.5 minutes. Let's take a quick look also at Anne Wright's piece about It's titled U.S. Open Doors After Vietnam War and Could Do So Again. And in reference to Central America, to me, it's almost like, you had the Comprador class from Southeast Asia.
Yep.
That, you know, came running back to Papa, basically, to the United States after, the day of reckoning took place. You have almost the opposite dynamic in Honduras.
Right.
You had the actual democratically elected government taken out by a U.S.-backed coup, and the people that are fleeing the Nazis, that were placed in power by the Obama administration, coming here, and now they're seeing a wall put up in front of them saying, maybe we can let them in.
Yeah, no, you're right. That's a good point. No question about that. I don't know if all the Vietnamese were people who had served the United States and were fleeing, but certainly that was, I think, the vast majority of them, and it is a very different crowd. But it's funny that while Anne wrote this piece before this article came out in the Atlantic saying that Trump wants to go back and kick out some of these Vietnamese from the 70s.
Yeah, I saw that.
Imagine that? So that was quite a coincidence that she had already written this piece.
Yeah.
And then Trump made this statement. So, I mean, the argument, and it's a really, really complex one, it has created a lot of division in our comment section on this. There's a lot of people who were really upset with her because they feel that these immigrants should not be allowed in because the U.S. working class is suffering as much as they do.
Right.
I understand that. But as you pointed out, the U.S. was responsible very much for what happened in Honduras, as an example. And just like in the Middle East, they were certainly responsible for Libya and Syria. They have had a huge role. And the ongoing economic exploitation of Africa, so that creates economic migrants. And then there are war refugees. And the West has a direct hand in both of them without question. That's so right. There is a responsibility. The responsibility begins with not doing those things, not exploiting the African continent, not backing a coup in Honduras, not bombing the hell out of Libya and overthrowing the government and creating this mess. So that's where it should start.
Exactly.
And that's where the argument has to begin. And it never does in the corporate media. It's only the result of these actions that we talk about and never the causes.
The corporate media failed to report that, as a matter of fact, with the invasion of Libya, that Muammar Gaddafi was predicting exactly what's happened, would happen, that did happen, and now all of the fallout from that. All right, Joe, we got to finish here. Thank you very much, and we'll catch up with you next week.
Very good, Don. Thank you for having me again. Bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The U.S. Senate strongly rebukes Saudi Arabia over the Khashoggi murder and calls for an end to the American involvement in the war on Yemen. Is this a defining moment for this bilateral relationship? Will so-called values trump hard geopolitical realities? Crosstalking Saudi Arabia, I'm joined by my guest Hussein Aboukaiti in Sana. He's a Yemeni journalist. In Riyadh, we have Ahmed Al-Ibrahim. He is a U.S.-Saudi relations expert. And in Brighton, we cross to Catherine Shakhdam. She is a senior analyst with Al Bayan Center. All right, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Ahmed, let me go to you first in Riyadh. How are you reacting to the rebuke from the U.S. Senate? It was quite strong, unanimous when it came to Khashoggi. And a majority when it came to America's, at least how the Senate sees America's role on your country's led war against Yemen. So what's the reaction there? Your reaction, and if you just want to repeat the government's reaction, that's all right as well. Go ahead in Riyadh.
Well, definitely, Peter, as you know, the Saudi Arabia, all avenues, they actually denounce what the Congress have done. The Congress itself, too many people probably doesn't understand. They always have these kind of symbolic agreement of doing things, but it doesn't mean that it's decisive because it has to be run down to the Senate, to the House, and then from the House, the President have to sign off of it. Yes, it is a problem. Yes, it is symbolic. But Saudi Arabia refuse anybody actually take the measures in order to interfere with their internal issues. Saudi Arabia has played on a bigger role that regarding the war in Yemen, that Saudi Arabia, the first country, actually would like to stop the war in Yemen if the all parties come into an agreement and for the benefit of the legitimate Yemeni government, where actually the involvement in Khashoggi, he's a Saudi citizen, happened in a Saudi soil, and it's an internal matter that Saudi Arabia is really working day in and day out in order to basically get the interrogation right. All those people who is politicizing the Khashoggi incident, actually, Saudi Arabia rejects it very hard and reject any actually action has been taken for from any country interfering in the Saudis' local issues.
Okay, Ahmed, but if he hadn't been murdered by people close to the crown prince, it wouldn't have been politicized. I think you would agree with that. Hussein, let me go to you in Sana. I mean, you must be gleeful that finally the U.S. Senate is speaking out on a war that the United States is involved in illegally under the War Powers Act. And unfortunately, it took the murder of a journalist/insider for the American public to actually start talking about it and to percolate it up to their elected politicians. I would disagree with Ahmed. I mean, they must be very, very angry in Riyadh because nothing like this has ever been said about Saudi Arabia at this level of high politics in the United States. So it's a first.
Yes, I think it's good that the Senate has taken this stand, even though it's only about, it has started this case only after the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. And as your guest in Riyadh said, I don't believe that this could reach a final decision either from the Congress or from Trump, because Trump still has the power to veto any resolution. But what's good about this Senate resolution is that they have actually confirmed that Mohammed bin Salman is directly behind the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. And as well, when they said to stop the support for Saudi Arabia war on Yemen, this means that United States is admitting that they are supporting this war and they are part of this war. And to be honest, this is not an incident. This is a killing of a journalist who worked with the Washington Post. It doesn't matter if it was your embassy or not. But the main problem with Saudi Arabia, at the beginning, they kept denying everything. They even said that he has left the embassy. They were trying to cover it with everything. And at the end, it appears that he did leave the embassy, but in suitcases, they have chopped him in pieces. So here in Yemen, actually, after the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, Yemeni here were kind of saying finally that the international media is giving attention to Yemen, and they are giving more attention to Yemen because they have felt, especially the Washington Post, that Mohammed bin Salman can get away from the killing. So the Washington Post and other media directed their eyes into Yemen because they've seen that Saudi Arabia has done so many crimes in Yemen, Mohammed bin Salman responsible for.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm glad that the Washington Post finally spoke up, but they basically back hook, line, and sinker American foreign policy in the Middle East. So I'm not giving them a whole lot of credit, if you know what I mean. Catherine, let me go to you. I mean, this vote in the Senate, Ahmed is absolutely right. I mean, the House of Representatives cowardly deferred even debating it. Maybe the new Congress will in January when the Democrats take over in the House here. But nonetheless, it puts this relationship, the Saudi-American relationship, very much in the spotlight. And that is something that both countries do not like to have happen. They'd like to have it kept behind the scenes because at the end of the day, there's a lot of hypocrisy, you know. Well, it's about geopolitics or it's about values or we choose one side or the other. I mean, depending on what you want to hear, okay? But this is a very powerful relationship and people finally are beginning to talk about it. It's pluses and it's minuses. Go ahead, Catherine.
Well, I think it's a good thing because I think this time actually plays in our favor in the sense that international law might actually get, be appalled as far as morality goes and ethics. I mean, we're talking about an illegal war in Yemen, however one wants to frame it. And, you know, the murder of Saudi national, you know, on foreign soil. So however Saudi Arabia wants to frame it, whether it's it's infringement on its, you know, internal policy or not, the point is, you know, the law was broken. And for once, Saudi Arabia is becoming accountable. And the international community, in particular Washington, is willing to actually, you know, ask the hard questions. Of course, it's been politicized, and it's a great case of moral relativism. That being said, again, I think it plays in our favor on the long term, in the sense that Saudi Arabia has a lot to answer to, and now it's going to have to play by the rules of the games, you know, or decide to be completely isolated. So it's a decision that Riyadh's going to have to make for itself. Now, as far as the U.S. and the Saudi relationship goes, I think there is still a change. I don't think it's just a symbolic move here. I think this signals a real change in the way that policy would be formulated in Washington. And I think the reason being that Donald Trump is facing a lot of legal issues. And so, you know, Mohammed bin Salman could face, you know, political issues and internal issues in Saudi Arabia. So the two leaders are not in a very comfortable position. So that, again, could play in the favor of the region as far as peace goes, and particularly Yemen, since we're referring to Yemen. So I would say great for Yemen, great for other people around the world who would like to see the Saudi held accountable, and maybe great to Washington as well. Maybe we'll regain some kind of a moral ground by actually advocating the law for once. And, you know, I know it's politicized, but still, I mean, it's a good thing as far as I'm concerned.
Ahmed, let me go back to you in Riyadh. I mean, in the official statement that came from the House of Saud is that the Senate vote was a violation of an interference into the internal affairs of Saudi Arabia. But, I mean, it's a kind of rich, isn't it, when essentially the Lebanese prime minister was kidnapped in your country, forced to resign. I mean, isn't that meddling in the affairs of Lebanon, let alone the war that you're waging against the internal affairs of Yemen?
Peter, you know, when I would like to state a fact, I would like to have the outlet. I would like the prime minister of Lebanon actually say that he was kidnapped in Saudi Arabia and he was resigned. We didn't hear that. We don't know how much of this is true. But however, with respect to your guest, the problem is deeper than that. MBS is a very strong ally to Donald Trump. The Senate have a problem. There is a problem with the senators, and there is a problem with the House of Representatives. Something has struck breakdown in the Senate. It's probably close to a mad cow disease happened to some of the senators by interfering in the Saudis issue. There is a breakdown within the Senate. You know, there is a problem.
You know, I mean,
there
I'm,
is a problem.
Man,
there
I'm
is a
not,
problem
you know,
against Trump.
You're talking about a possible breakdown of some kind of democratic process. But isn't that a bit rich from you coming from Saudi Arabia, where probably you couldn't find a dictionary with the word democracy in it? So, I mean, I think it's a bit rich on your side.
Can I say something?
Go ahead, Peter. Jump in. That's the point of the program.
Well, because you're referring to, you know, the Prime Minister Hariri and this so-called kidnapping. I mean, I recall my president, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, having to intervene because Mr. Hariri happens to be a French national as well. This is not a conspiracy.
You guys are repeating leaks. This is all
knowledge.
Leaks.
I'm sorry.
Let's talk on the ground. Let's talk on the facts. Let's talk about the senators.
Hang on.
The senators.
Please, you're talking.
The senators has issued something.
You're talking over each other. Come on. You're talking over each other.
And you're sitting right now in Riyadh alleging that, you know, America is not, because, you know, God forbid America actually criticized Mohammed bin Salman. You're arguing that it's an infringement on your own policies? Are you kidding me? This is beyond hypocritical. You're waging an entire war on the premise.
I'm going to give Ahmed please, Catherine, please. Ahmed, go ahead. We have about 40 seconds before we go to the break. They're all yours. Okay. Go ahead.
No problem. It's all speculation. Listen, the Senate, at the end of the day, they decided it's like Jasta. Jasta was born and was dead on the floor of the Senate. We really, at the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, does not care what the senator thinks. We know how to manage ourselves, right? The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is 18 out of the G20. We're progressing very well. We're doing economically very well. We have the Khashoggi problem. We're going to solve it. There's people detained. There's people who's going to actually maybe get executed. There's people who's going to go to prison. So we are managing our internal issue very well. I think MBS is taking us at the speed of the Formula E that just happened last week, and we're moving on. We don't care what America thinks. We don't care what Macron thinks. We don't care what Britain thinks. We are going straight. We have allies. If they want to ban weapons, okay. Good luck. The market is all ours. We can do a lot of things. I'm going to jump in here.
We're going to go to a break. If they don't care, then why did they write a rebuke to the U.S. government? Anyway, I'm going to go to a break. After a short break, we'll continue our discussion on Saudi Arabia. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to Hussein and Sana. I want to kind of enter the realm of speculation since Ahmed wanted to bring the U.S. process into this whole debate. Then let's do that. You had the head of the CIA was barred from an initial meeting on the evidence or speculation investigation the CIA had regarding the death of Khashoggi. Eventually, she was allowed to speak to the appropriate committee, and she came out with what was publicly known, that highly likely that the Crown Prince himself was involved in this. The reason why I'm bringing this up, because it seems to me, if you look at some of the senators, they just don't like MBS. They love Saudi Arabia. They just don't like this guy because of his road record, because of Syria, because of Lebanon, because of Yemen. And of course, the claims of reform, which I guess have a lot more time to be developed. But nonetheless, he doesn't fit the profile of the deep state in the U.S. likes, because MBS is I'll try to be as generous as possible, kind of erratic at times. Go ahead, Insana.
Many Senate, they don't like Saudi Arabia, but before they couldn't actually find a clear case of Saudi committing a crime in front of the entire world. And it was when they killed Jamal Khashoggi. And the relation between United States and Saudi Arabia is based on money. We remember that Trump have said many times in his mid-election in the U.S., he said that we protect Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia cannot last for 2 weeks. They have to pay. And the Saudi has not given a single clear, strong response to Trump's statement. On the other hand, we see them. They took really a serious step against Canada. This show you that what Trump has actually said, it was really that the existence of Saudi Arabia cannot continue only with the help of the United States. And I'm going to just tell you that here in Yemen, actually, we think that Trump, we can say one of the best president of the United States, because all the previous president, for example, they have started war in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya, and Obama and Trump, now they raging this war against Yemen. And why we think that he's the best? Because he have actually exposed the United States. It's not about the value, it's not about spreading democracy, it's not about the freedom of speech, it's about who's going to pay. Trump is like, he's now leading the largest mercenary army in the world. And it's clearly that you pay him, he can silent anyone. And his step that he will continue his relation with Saudi Arabia, he mentioned about money. So this show you that the war, for example, on Yemen and the blockade on Yemen is about how much Saudi Arabia is going to give to United States.
I don't want to burst your bubble here, but it's very unclear if Donald Trump is even running his own foreign policy, considering the people that he has surrounded himself with. Let's go to Brighton there. I want to continue this theme, Catherine, because I think it's really important. I think that the powers that be in the United States, and we can put Donald Trump aside, because we always put Donald Trump aside for some reason these days. They want a good, strong relationship with Saudi Arabia. But there seems to be growing evidence that the leadership of Saudi Arabia is what they have questions about. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at Lindsey Graham coming out with such, you know, I think I'm going to paraphrase, he has to go, referring to MBS here. And that gives me reason to believe also the CIA, that this is some kind of message not coming from the White House, but coming from the CIA, coming from well-connected people in the deep state. It's one of the reasons they've come out so strongly publicly about an ally that they very rarely publicly talk about. Go ahead and Brighton.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have to remember in the first place that the CIA knew all along, but chose to actually literally left him, to hang, quite literally. because they wanted to, and I think it fits within the predetermined political narrative, as you mentioned. I think the issue here is not so much the U.S.-Saudi relationship, again, as you mentioned, but it has more to do with Mohammed bin Salman and the role that he might play in the future. And I think that his role has been cancelled de facto. He's not going to have anyone to play. I would compare the situation to that of Saddam Hussein in Iraq when Iraq waged a war in Iran, you know, in the 1980s, and that actually fell to manifest the U.S. agenda there. And I think that because Mohammed bin Salman has failed in Yemen and has failed in Lebanon and has failed in Syria and Iraq into manifesting any time of any type of regime change, and he hasn't done anything, you know, in his countries by way of reforming the way that the U.S. wanted to. So he has failed on all accounts. If anything, he actually has made the House of Saud much more weaker because he has literally, you know, broke out, you know, little, I would say, little wars within the royal family, kind of exploding those ties that were once upon a time quite stable. The economy is not doing, you know, not faring too well. However, your guest wants, you know, is trying to paint it. We all know that Saudi Arabia is hurting because of the war in Yemen and many other issues. So it's problematic. Now, Mohammed bin Salman has become a liability and literally has to go. So I think the Khashoggi case came, you know, as a Christmas gift, really. To Washington, D.C. state, in that now they have a reason.
Amazing.
Because you have to find a reason, you have to create a narrative, and that, the narrative today is he's a war criminal, and he has murdered, you know, Khashoggi, who happened to be not only a former intelligence officer, but as well a journalist for the Washington Post. And so, you know, for the Washington establishment, it's very, very convenient now to paint Mohammed bin Salman as the man, you know, that committed all those crimes and that, you know, need to go for the regime to be able to endure and for business to resume, essentially. Okay. So, yeah, I think he's going to become a scapegoat. But, I mean, why not? He has committed all those crimes. So, I mean, I'm for one would not be too sad to see him go. And I think that the Saudi would be quite happy to see him go, too, as well as the Yemeni.
Okay, let's go back to Riyadh. I noticed you were disagreeing with Catherine, so please reply.
I mean, I'm sorry, Catherine, all your facts are wrong. I mean, I wish you could say half of this on Bashar al-Assad, who actually killed more than 500,000 people, and he actually displaced 10 million Syrians. But anyway, let me continue. Lindsey Graham, I know him personally. Very nice guy, but I don't know what happened to Lindsey Graham.
But Saudi Arabia had nothing. Saudi Arabia had nothing to do with that.
Okay. Saudi Arabia. Listen, nobody said what MBS has done for the country and for the world. Nobody says what Saudi Arabia has done for the whole world. You guys sitting there, you know, Lindsey Graham sitting there, he has to go. You know what? It's like somebody here in the Saudi Congress talking about Lindsey Graham, saying, you know what, Lindsey Graham, you need to step down. This is not going to happen. The more people attack MBS, the more support he's going to get internally. And his stocks and his rating is at best, believe me, whether you guys like it or not. This is the problem, you know, fake news. At the end of the day, you know, you have those lefties in America. And let me tell you one thing. This is not the first time that Saudi Arabia did that to the United States. This is actually the second time. The first time when Obama came over to Saudi Arabia and King Abdullah did not even actually greet him at the airport. And he has to flew from the airport to the oasis that King Abdullah was there. Why? Because he lied. He was about to treat the Iranian file in all fairness. And he went and he basically jumped in the mullah's hands and took America into Iran. So what I'm saying is, listen, don't get excited about Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is not the villain or the country that you can bully. We can live without you. We can live without Macron. We can live without Theresa May. And we can do that with the state. But we're going to respect our allies. Okay. We're going to continue with our traditional ally, which is the United States. However, we're not going to put all our eggs in one basket, my dear.
All right, Ahmed, thank you very much. Catherine, real quick, and then I want to go back to Hussein.
Yeah, I just want to ask the question because Ahmed is sitting in Riyadh. So I would like to know, how long do you think would you survive by criticizing your precious Mohammed bin Salman? Because we can't really take what you say at face value, because you're sitting in Riyadh and you might be butchered by leaving
Mohammed
the building.
Mohammed bin Salman will survive for a little bit, maybe 40, 45 years from now. You're going to live another 45 years with MBS. Trust me. You're going to live with him for a long time, my dear, when he's becoming a king.
And God
very
help
soon.
Us.
Okay, let's go. I want to go back to Sana. Okay, you know, let's get away from NBS. That's a separate problem to deal with here. How do you see this? We have peace talks. I can ask you right now, is the ceasefire at the port city, is it in effect right now? Because I've been reading reports that it is. Is it, is with the Senate vote, with this momentum and the public awareness, because there's a whole lot more public awareness now about Yemen. I've been doing it from the very beginning. I'm so happy that people are talking about it, because this conflict can, it's doable to end it, and it ended relatively quickly. Okay. And that process has started. So what's your position? How do you see things moving forward now? You're in the country.
Yeah. I think, the ceasefire in Hodeidah city is keeping really well. I mean, despite the constant, the Saudi fighter jet and drones is still over the sky of Hodeidah. There are sometimes machine gunshot here and there. But this is the first time in Yemen since the beginning of the war in 26th of March 2015 that a ceasefire actually was not breached. And I think the reason of that is because of the pressure on Saudi Arabia from international community, and as well from media and from the Congress, and all that has come after the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. We had talks in Geneva, we had talks in Kuwait, but none of these talks has come up with a good truce plan or a ceasefire. And Saudi Arabia, in intervention in Yemen, and I just want to reply to your guest Riyadh when he said what Saudi Arabia has done, they have done all good. No, they haven't. The only thing they did, maybe, that people thought is good, is when they allow women to drive. Just imagine a country that doesn't allow women to drive. And they allow them to drive, and after some weeks, they have jailed the female activists who were happy with this so-called step. And we've seen that the media actually is the international media fault, because they have been making this Mohammed bin Salman.
We're talking about the ceasefire in Yemen. We're talking about the ceasefire.
I finished the ceasefire
very well.
Heard me.
Saudi Arabia actually is a candidate to have the ceasefire.
Gentlemen,
stop.
I'm going to give Catherine the last 20 seconds. Yeah. Catherine, go. Yeah. Listen, Catherine.
20 seconds is a lot.
All I'm going to say is that I think that Ahmed, in Riyadh, really demonstrated how very insecure Saudi Arabia feel, because whenever you attack them, they have to deflect and pronounce however grand they are when they're not. We all know that economically Saudi Arabia is failing, okay. Politically it's failing, militarily failing, it doesn't have an army.
All right, I'm going to jump in here. Clearly, there's a lot more to say. We have run out of time. Many thanks to my guests in Sana, Riyadh, and in Brighton. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.